Good morning. Welcome to another edition of Weekend Magazine. We have a very historic, patriotic site we're going to go to today. We're going to be speaking with Tim Rizzuto, who is the executive director and the ship superintendent for the USS Slater. Tim, hi.
Good morning. How are you?
Very, very good. We know you opened, I think, in May, so I knew it would be time for us to get up and talk to you.
Yeah, actually, we usually open for the first Wednesday in April, so we've got a couple months under our belt so far.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's going good.
All right. Now, first of all, maybe you could tell people where is the Slater and what is it, and then maybe some of the history of the Slater.
Well, we're located in Albany, New York, on Hudson, at the foot of Madison Avenue, on what they used to call a snow dock, because they used to dump the snow there in the winter time. And USS Slater is a National Historic Landmark, and it's a World War II destroyer escort. And to avoid the confusion, we have to explain to people, these ships don't escort destroyers, okay? Destroyers were faster, small combat ships that used to escort the fast carriers and the battleships. Oh. Destroyer escorts was kind of a scaled-down version designed to escort the merchant convoys. If you've heard of the Liberty and Victory ships in World War II, they used to travel as a pack, you know, to avoid submarines. And these destroyer escorts were designed to escort the convoys across the Atlantic to get the supplies to England.
Wow, so they were pretty, they could take care of business if something happened, huh?
That was, their main purpose was anti-submarine warfare. You know, the whole strategic picture in World War II was that, you know, after Germany conquered pretty much all of Europe, you know, the next step was to starve out England, so they used submarines in the Atlantic to try to sink all the ships that were trying to get the supplies and the troops to England, so we could start the D-Day invasion and start the Second Front, so to speak, you know, the Eastern Front with Russia being their biggest problem.
Uh-huh.
And so the German U-boat threat was to try to sink all these ships that were coming into England bringing supplies, and so the destroyer escorts were designed to protect those convoys so the supplies could get through to England, and ultimately we could invade Europe and, you know, win the war.
Oh, boy, they were important, huh, in the whole scheme of things.
Very important, And there are basically three things that beat the U-boat. One, the destroyer escorts and the convoys were one of them. The second was they created small aircraft carriers that used to escort the convoys, and patrol planes, aircraft, played a big role in anti-submarine warfare. And then the third thing was radio intelligence. You know, we were intercepting and decoding the German radio messages, so we always had a sense of where those U-boats were.
Oh, wow. Very, very nice. So this Slater served when? When was it operational? And then what happened to it? And
She was actually constructed down in Tampa, Florida, and she was built over a six-month period back then. She was one of 563 destroyer escorts built. And she was commissioned on May 1st, 1944, so we're coming up on our 75th anniversary of her commissioning next year.
Wow.
And the first duty she had was she was assigned to a torpedo bomber training down in Key West. She was a target for the torpedo planes, and the practice torpedoes were actually supposed to go under the ship, but she got hit, I think, about three times by practice torpedoes. You know, had to go into dry dock a couple times. And then when she was released from that duty in August of 1944, she joined a convoy escort group working out of the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and she ultimately made five transatlantic convoy crossings to England and Wales, escorting these convoys of merchant ships. And the destroyer escorts used to operate in six ship divisions.
Okay.
And then when the Germany surrendered in May of 1945, she was re-equipped with additional anti-aircraft guns, and she was sent to the Pacific for the anticipated invasion of Japan. Of course, we dropped the atom bombs, and that invasion never happened. So she did occupation duty over there for about 6 months, and then came home to Green Cove Springs, Florida, where she decommissioned in 1946.
Okay. So she was down in Florida all this time?
She was down in Florida until 1951, and then under the terms of the Military Defense Assistance Program, where we equipped our NATO allies with ships, so if another war with Russia and the Soviet Union ever broke out, you know, we'd be prepared to fight them.
Uh-huh.
So the Slater was one of four ships transferred to the Greek Navy in 1951, and she served the Greek Navy for 40 years until 1991, serving as a patrol vessel and also training naval cadets out of the Greek Naval Academy.
Wow, that's so interesting.
The Greeks have have a lot of fondness for this ship. If you look at on our Facebook page, you know, the largest concentration of our friends is from the New York area.
Yeah.
But the next largest concentration is from Athens, Greece, if you can believe that.
Isn't that
so? We
something?
Have a lot of friends on Facebook from Greece.
That's amazing. That's so the ship was there for how long? Till
Greek Navy for 40 years.
40 you know? Years.
And, okay. and then they decommissioned it in 1991. And okay. At that time, the Destroyer Escort Sailors Association was looking to preserve a ship. Now, this kind of gets off on another tangent. Most of these destroyer escorts during World War II were manned by naval reservists,
right.
not regular Navy guys. And after the war, you know, they got out of the Navy and went back to their civilian jobs. But as they came upon retirement age, they started to get nostalgic about their wartime service. And they kind of felt like because they were reservists, their duty was never really properly recognized by the Navy.
Uh-huh.
So they did two things, basically. They set out to find a ship that they could set up as a museum, and the Greek government offered to donate the Slater back to the veterans group, you know,
oh.
if they could raise the money to tow it across the Atlantic, which they did.
Very
and
nice.
Then they also set the third Saturday in June as Destroyer Escort Day, where we remember the 15 destroyer escorts that were lost during World War II, and I think it's 1,323 sailors that went down with those ships.
Oh, okay.
So we just commemorated that a couple of weeks ago. So
that and that's every year on the third Saturday, if
every
anybody...
Every year on the third Saturday in June we do that.
Okay, everybody can mark their calendars then for next year. That's
Yeah. Mm.
So they found a way to get it back across. That had to be an expensive...
It was $290,000 it cost. They actually
wow.
used a Ukrainian tugboat. This big ocean-going tugboat was supposed to come over to the United States to pick up two destroyers that we were giving to the Greek Navy. These were modern guided missile destroyers that we
uh-huh.
were decommissioning. And so rather than come across empty, they made a deal to tow the Slater across on the way to pick up these two destroyers that were going back to Greece. So the Slater was originally part of the Intrepid Sea Air Space Museum from 1993 until 1997, and they started the initial restoration work down there. They had a great volunteer group with the what they call the Statue of Liberty chapter of the Destroyer Escort Sailors Association, and they really got the thing off the ground. But in 97, the Intrepid Park had a management change, and they decided they had acquired too many ships, and three ships were asked to find new homes, and Mayor Jennings here in Albany said he'd give the Slater a home. So
wow.
It was towed up to Albany in 1997, and we've had a great volunteer contingent working on it ever since. We average about 15,000 volunteer man hours a year,
wow.
and almost all of our maintenance is done by volunteers. These
wow.
guys are just an amazing group of people. They've got this thing looking like it was commissioned. You know?
Wow.
So.
Well, having a capital district as the area you're working out of, that's fantastic. You got more people living nearby, and yeah.
That really has worked out great for
yeah.
us. In a way, you never think of Albany as a Navy town, but in a sense, the Slater's made it a Navy town. So.
Well, that's one of three deepwater ports on the Hudson, right? It was Albany.
Right.
Was it Haverstraw and Newburgh, were they, the three?
They used to have the reserve fleet off Haverstraw Bay there in the
uh-huh.
From the 50s to the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And then Kingston, they have a shipyard in Kingston, and they do a good bit of traffic out of Kingston.
Yeah,
so.
And we had one in Newburgh. We were building ships
I know they built a lot of ships in World War II in Newburgh.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I guess it had to do with you had to have room to be able to turn ships around or something that determines deep water.
Yeah, up the Hudson there was more that they did. I know they built a Liberty ship up in Albany, but it was usually the patrol craft, the submarine chasers and minesweepers, the smaller ships that were built in the Hudson. So.
Wow, isn't that so? So that was great. That you got to give a medal to what is it, Jenner, Mayor Jenner? You said
Mayor Jennings. Yeah,
Jennings.
We just talked to him last week. We're kind of reminiscing about the early days when the Slater came to Albany.
Oh, he did a lot of good. And I'll tell you, tourism-wise, that is an incredible attraction for tourism. I mean,
we, on the website, tripadvisor.com, we are listed as the number one tourist attraction in Albany. We get
wow.
some really great comments because we do all guided tours. So we have a lot of young interns and old veterans, you know, who take people to the ship and explain everything to them. And the thing that impresses people most is that it's like a time capsule where we haven't made it like a museum. We We've actually made it like a World War II destroyer. And people are so impressed with how these guys lived like this. You know, they were packed in 200 guys on this little ship. You know, they slept in these canvas bunks, three high, you know, no privacy. You know, it's amazing the sacrifices that they made.
Yeah.
People just aren't used to living like that nowadays.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so important, too, because the young people need to see these things. They don't realize it. Everything looks so easy for them, and, you know, they don't understand the sacrifices that were made that, you know. And you still got some elderly, you know, vets still here to help, so that's good.
Yeah, that's the saddest part of this job, is just watching the World War II generation slip away, because we remind these kids today that this is the last generation that's actually going to know World War II veterans.
Yeah.
It won't be many years before all these guys are gone.
You got to get your vet groups to videotape all these guys. Let them talk and get it all on tape. And
We have that on our website. We have a whole series of oral histories and video interviews that we've done with these guys, so you can really get a sense of, you know, what they went through back then.
Wow.
You know?
All right, so why don't we, let's do a tour of the boat. Then we could also talk about the website and everything, and then, you know, see how much we could tell our listeners about you.
Okay, well, when you come down to the ship, the tourists leave every 20 minutes, and we have some time, a gift shop to buy souvenirs in, and then out in the observation deck, we have a series of panels that show what the ship looked like when it first came over from Greece, so people can appreciate all the work that's gone into it. And then we have a 7-minute orientation video that kind of puts the ship in historical context for visitors to watch before we actually take them on the ship. And then they'll go aboard in groups of usually 5 to 15 people led by a tour guide, and you go across the bow to the quarterdeck, where we explain, you know, this is where the quarterdeck watch stood, and this is where they posted their security, you know, and kept the logbook when they were in port. And then from the quarterdeck, we take them into the galley so they can see how the food was prepared for the sailors during World War II. And you got to imagine you're trying to prepare this food while your ship is getting tossed and turned in the ocean. You know, you're getting picked up to 15 feet in the air, thrown forward about 25 yards, and dropped back down, you know?
Yeah. Shaken, not stirred, right? That's all.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They say that the hardest thing was just that it wore you out just trying to hang on and keep your balance all the time.
Did they make special kitchen things that were specific to that kind of tossed around kind of thing?
Like the stove had a railing around it, you know, and you could, so each pot could have like a piece of flat bar holding it in place to keep it from sliding around, you know.
I was going to say.
Big steam kettles had covers on them that you could, you know, close down to keep the stuff from slopping out over onto the deck and burning you. So
yeah, because they could have a lot of injuries if everything was loose.
A galley was a dangerous place to work back then, especially in a storm. But usually they'd secure in a storm, and you'd just eat, you know, cooked sandwiches and cold cuts would be about all they could prepare for you. So.
Sure, sure. Okay, so I understand that. That makes a lot of sense. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So keep going.
So then we take them up to the bow of the ship, and we look at what we call the Hedgehog, was a forward-firing anti-submarine weapon. It fired 24 mortar-like bombs over the bow of the ship, so they could, you know, attack a submarine while it was ahead of them, and they still had sonar contact, because World War II sonar just looked ahead. Once you got over the submarine to drop depth charges, you lost contact. And then there's also the 3-inch gun. This is one of the bigger guns in the ship. It fires about a 24-pound shell about 6 miles, you know, and it could be used against surface targets in any aircraft, and the kids can crank this gun around and just feel what it was really like. And then we talk about the anchoring gear, which is all the anchors are up on the forecastle, too. And then we take them inside the ship, and we go through officers' country. And the officers lived in the two-man staterooms, and they were pretty lucky. They had their own header bathroom, and they had their everybody had a porthole. Uh-huh. And there are 4 staterooms there. The one had the executive officer was the number 2 man on the ship, and he actually had a private stateroom to himself. And then the next compartment we go into is the officer's wardroom or dining room. And that also served as the main battle dressing station. If you were wounded in battle, the ship's doctor or pharmacist mate would be stationed there, and they'd work on you right on the wardroom dining table.
Wow.
They actually had surgical lamps on top of the table so they could do the surgeries right there if they needed to. And then we take them down below into the mess decks, and we see the difference between how the officers lived. You know, they had nice china and silver service on their table. And then you go down below with the crew ate on the mess hall off metal trays. You know, same thing you get if you go to Austin State Penitentiary. You know? Metal tray, so if you drop it, it doesn't break. And then we go into the forward berthing compartments, or living spaces, and this is where like 36 sailors would live together. And all they had was a little square 3x3 locker to keep all their belongings in. Wow. And so their pea coats and stuff, uniforms are usually under their mattresses so they'd stay pressed.
Well, so what kind of clothes would somebody have when they were on that kind of duty?
The normal duty, what you were normally wearing was dungarees. You had the pair of bell-bottom blue jeans and a chambray work shirt, and then you had a sweater, but you also had thermal underwear and a lot of heavy outer clothing in case you were operating in the North Atlantic in the wintertime. So stowing all this stuff was a real problem because there wasn't much space for personal gear.
Yeah.
And during that time period, sailors weren't allowed to have any civilian clothes on the ship. When you went ashore, you either wore your dress blues or your dress whites, depending upon what the season was. So
they had blue, they had white. You're thinking dry and warm are the things that are the necessities.
Yeah. And then, because if you're in the tropics, everything changes. You get rid of the blues, which are made out of wool, and you wear the white cotton uniform.
Oh, I see.
And then we take the people up onto the main deck again, and we go up to the what we call the 01 level, which is one level above the main deck, and we go into the radio room and look at the captain's cabin and the ship's office. And then from there up to the pilot house and the combat information center. And the chart room is up there, too. The chart room is where they kept track of their position on the surface of the Earth and did all their navigation. And then the Combat Information Center has all the radar equipment in there. And that's where they do essentially what the same thing as air traffic controllers do. They keep track of all the ships and aircraft that you're operating with, and they plot all these contacts. You know, they're in the convoy on a big plotting board, a polar coordinate chart. And then the whole idea is if somebody shows up on radar who wasn't there before, that's the one you know you have to worry about. That's the bogey. That potentially is the enemy.
So when we're watching all these movies, what we're seeing then is usually one of the combat info center or a chart room. Those are the big,
Like the nerve center of the ship, and usually when they go to battle stations, the number two man in the ship, the executive officer, will be in the combat information center, and he'll advise the captain on the most immediate threat to the ship, and he basically designates what the target is and gives that information to the captain and the gunnery officer, and then the captain makes a decision whether they should fire on it or not. So, because up above the pilot house, they have the flying bridge, and this is where they control all the guns from. They have the gunnery officer, the director, and he can move all the guns together, the battery, by moving this one gun director, and so he keeps everybody on target. So.
Wow, sounds incredible. Okay. How long does this tour take? This is a good.
It usually takes about an hour, 15 minutes, depending upon the guide and how many questions they ask.
Very, very, very good so far.
We take them down along the signal bridge where we have the flag bags where they have all the different colored signal flags where they make up messages, and they also have the blinker lights right there for sending Morse code by blinker.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go back down to the 01 level and walk along the by the smokestack where we have the motor whaleboat there that uses the ship's motor launch if they're anchored out and they have to get the crew back and forth to shore, or at sea they might have to pick up a pilot or rescue survivors. That's the motor boat is kept on deck there, and then we put that in the water in the summertime and actually run it around. And then we go back aft and we look at the anti-aircraft guns. We have 20 millimeter heavy machine guns, and then the big Bofors 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns that was really probably one of the most effective anti-aircraft guns in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And a curious thing about these two guns was the 20-millimeter was a Swiss designed by the Ehrlich and Company, and the Bofors was designed in Sweden. So both these guns were designed by neutral countries because we couldn't design a decent heavy anti-aircraft gun in World War II, and these companies sold to both sides, so go figure that.
Wonder why. Their precision work or something?
They were just well-designed guns, when we built them in this country under license, so it's kind of interesting. A bit of trivia there.
Oh, yeah.
And then back down to the main deck again, and we go past the depth charge projectors and the depth charges they used to drop into submarines. And then back inside the ship, we see the damage control locker. When you're at sea, you can't call a fire department or an ambulance, so you have to be able to handle your own emergencies. And then the after cruise head, where there were four shower stalls and seven sinks for the whole crew. That's where the 150 guys lived in the back end of the ship, and that's where they'd all wash up. So you can imagine what that was like, getting ready in the morning for inspection. And then
did they schedule themselves, or was it like whoever could get in next kind of a thing?
Basically, you didn't waste any time. You got in and got out.
Yeah.
And then we're back to the quarter deck again, and that's the end of the tour. You know?
Wow.
And that's where we have our donation box, and we ask everybody to leave a donation, you know, and people have been really generous to us.
Okay.
And that's one of the important things about this is this ship up to this this year hasn't received any federal or state funding. All the money we receive to operate this ship, which is about, I'm going to say, about $300,000 a year, all comes from our ticket sales and donations. We
wow.
have 3,000 member donor base nationwide who support this thing and are very dedicated to us. And now as the old destroyer escort sailors are passing away, it's the kids and the grandkids that are signing up to become members. So
fantastic. And so what is your ticket cost? And donations, of course, anybody can give it whatever they want beyond that.
Yeah, we're $9 for adults and $8 for seniors and $7 for children. You know, and then kids under 6 are free when they're with their parents. So.
Good. Under 6.
And we run the tours Wednesday to Sunday from 10 until 4, you know. Monday, Tuesday are normally our maintenance days, but if the holiday falls on a Monday, we'll be open for the holiday.
And you're open on the holidays, like 4th of July and Memorial?
We're always open for the holidays. You know, the only holidays we close are Thanksgiving and Christmas. Other than that, we're there.
Okay.
And Easter. We close for Easter.
And Easter. That's good. That is fantastic. Now, I'm trying to think, if somebody wants to bring a group, either a school group, senior group, veteran group, what do they do? Is there anything special?
We have a discounted price for that, but they have to call in advance, and the phone number is 518-431-1943. That's 518-431-1943. And either Roseanne or Shannon will answer the phone, and they'll schedule in advance, so you'll have a tour guide waiting for you when you get there.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, as far as I know you can't go and change the ship, so it's handicap accessible. What kind of physical capability should somebody have when they're coming? Or is there a way that somebody can interact if they're in a wheelchair or something?
Yeah, in a wheelchair, we have video and we have a lot of photographic books that they can show what the ship looks like on the inside, you know. And basically, a lot of people, if they're older, will just make the main deck tour and then wait for the tour to catch up with them because we have places to sit down if you have difficulty with the ladders. So.
Okay, so anybody can go if they're strong enough to go up a ladder.
Yeah, as long as they're strong enough to make a ladder. If they're strong enough to get across the gangway, I'd say they can go, you know. So,
okay, good. And the other thing, too, maybe you should, we got about 3-4 minutes left. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your website so that people can get involved right away and see what's going on.
Yeah, two things. We have the website at www.ussslater.org, okay, and that gives an extensive tour of the ship and a lot of history about other destroyer escorts. And then we also have a very active Facebook page. We post daily, and we do a lot of posts about the maintenance work and the tour guides, what's going on in the ship. And then we also post a lot of historical photographs and information. Every Sunday we have Remember Ship Sunday, and we pick another destroyer escort, and we'll profile the history of that ship. Because, like I say, they built 563 of these ships, and they all contributed a great deal to the war effort. So,
this is great. Keep going.
These ships actually served. The last one went out of service in 1973. They did some of them did duty in Vietnam, but if you can believe it, the Thailand still has a sister ship of the Fletcher as their ceremonial flagship. They still operate it. And the Filipinos just got rid of one of theirs. They took it out of service last spring.
Uh-huh.
So that some of these ships were still running around the world. It's unbelievable.
It is.
The quality of the construction.
Oh, yeah. Well, they don't make them like that anymore, but I tell you. Yeah. My father used to be a welder. He helped to build the Missouri. And he was actually he was on a destroyer escort. He was also on Liberty ships. And I've got a picture of him where his helmet, a shell went through the helmet. There's this big hole, and he kept the helmet.
You have to scan that and send it to me. I'd like to see that.
If it was like another maybe half an inch lower, he said it would have blown his head off. So God wanted him around. That's the way we look at it.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Listen, Tim, we're running out of time here. Let's give the website your phone number again, and we urge everybody to make sure they take a trip. You said from April. How late are you open into the?
Well, we run the tours from April through November. We go through Thanksgiving weekend and. The Wednesday to Sunday from 10 until 4. And our phone number is 518-431-1943. That's 518-431-1943. And our website is www.ussslater.org.
Yep. You know? And on there, anybody can get your address and mail you a donation so that they can help support all your renovations and everything you have to do.
Oh, that's for sure. we encourage memberships and donations, because this whole thing has lived on charity as long as I've been here.
Well, that's a good thing. That's very good. It also shows everybody loves you, which is a good thing too.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, thank you very much, Tim Rizzuto from the Slater, and I hope you have a great weekend. Well, that's a wrap for this week. I hope you get a chance to get up to Albany and see the Slater. Take care.